101.9 FM. We're sitting with Joe Sacco, creator of Palestine. Safe area. How do you pronounce that?
Garajda.
Garajda. The Fixer, War's End, and Notes of Defeatist, and the most Notes from a Defeatist, and the most recent, But I Like It, Your Rock and Roll Days, I guess is a good way of putting it.
That's right.
That's right. So, this is a collection of old, what was in Yahoo?
The But I Like It book, that has one episode of Yahoo. That's the In the Company of Long Hair comic about going on tour with a rock band. That's that one. But it's a lot of stray bits from different eras of my life that have to do with music. That's kind of it, including posters.
And some great posters from some great bands like the Flaming Lips and
right.
Stuff I Like.
Well, thank you.
So, in the process of when you're on the tour, was there any situations which you kind of like, that'd be great, but that'd be go too far, exposing too much?
The answer is yes, and let's not get into it.
Alrighty.
Believe me, there was enough stuff in there that I mean, I could have really made it look good or bad, depending on your perspective. I had to, you know, ultimately you search out a few stories that are representative, some that are maybe a little too off-color. You just decide you leave out because there's just no point in really upsetting
you
an apple cart.
You could have an epic novel of madness on the road.
Yeah, and not just that, but I mean, these guys are my friends. You know, you protect your friends on some to some degree.
So they're still your friends.
They're still my friends. They liked being in the comic book.
One thing I noticed when reading it is there's a certain air of madness in some of the pages.
Madness?
Madness. Okay. Like, the way you utilize the formatting of the pages, there's like...
Yeah, I look at that. I was very much into psychedelia at the time, and they were sort of a neo-psychedelic band, and yeah, I almost wanted it to feel like a psychedelic experience somehow. And sometimes I look at that stuff and I question some of my decisions, but generally speaking, I was really in an experimental phase when I did that book.
Well, it's really neat. Yeah, totally the psychedelia. What kind of music were you into as a young guy?
As a young guy, if we're talking about the first time I listened to music that I myself was interested in rather than like what my friends were listening to, you know, basically the Beatles is the first band I liked, and the Rolling Stones, still like those bands. I got into sort of the whole garage thing. And
like the Stooges.
I wasn't so hot on the Stooges because I thought they acted so teenaged, you know. All their songs were about, I don't know, it was just too teenaged for me, too pimply somehow, you know. I didn't really care for it.
More Shock and Awe than...
Yeah, just too sneery in this way. But I mean, I still like the Stooges okay, but I wasn't like a huge follower. But I got into like obscure psychedelic bands, you know, the more obscure the better. And at that point, there were things that were beginning to be reissued, so you could search out certain bands. And now, of course, there's every garage band that ever got anywhere near a tape recorder has a re-release out or whatever. And it all seems ridiculous to me now that I was into that stuff. I sold a lot of those records. I have really no interest in hearing garage bands anymore.
What kind of stuff are you into now?
I listen to a fair amount of blues music, sort of Chicago blues, Delta blues, sort of blues that's really rhythmic as opposed to, you know, dittering around on the guitar.
Not so noodly.
I don't like noodly blues. I'm not even a big fan of B.B. King, though I acknowledge he's a master and all that, but that stuff, it doesn't really do it for me. I want kind of rough Charlie Patton type of music.
Something where you can tell the guy was sitting alone in a room. And
even that's not important. I mean, I like electronic music, too. I mean, I like electric music, too. I want to hear Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. Anything with real passion that isn't really trying to go for your pocket as opposed to your heart, you know? In other words, it's not trying to be sold in a way. And I listen to jazz. I started to listen to jazz a few years ago, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, and other things, and I'm really enjoying that.
Is there anything you'd like us to play on the show?
Yeah, you know, I'm really into the phase, the Miles Davis phase everyone hates, sort of that rock phase he went through. If you play Miles Davis tribute to Jack Johnson, that would be good. It's a good rocking. He wanted to have the most rocking the most rock, the best rock band in the world. He decided he would have a rock band, and it is. It's like an incredible rock band, and it's all dark sort of stuff. It's not light at all.
Well, he wasn't. He's a very dark man. Like I've heard. I haven't read his autobiography, but apparently it's just filled with motherfucker, motherfucker.
I want to read. Like I definitely want to read that book. I want to read that book.
A lot of hatred in there.
Maybe, but you know, he's an interesting guy, and he's a real genius, and he might be the. He might be the most interesting musician of the last century.
Oh, for sure.
You know, there, I've said it. Now everyone in Canada knows.
Joe Sacco likes Miles Davis. Can't blame you. It's good stuff. Thank you. in comics recently, there was the whole Muhammad controversy. I want to talk a little bit about that if you're up for it. You put your head down and you're sick of it.
I have to appear on stage with Art Spiegelman talking about it in Chicago, and I'm not relishing the fact. I mean,
do you think it's done now?
No, it's not done. It's still an important issue. It's still something worth talking about, perhaps, but I'm tired of thinking about it, but I'll talk about it for purposes of this conversation. I'll gird my loins. What do you want to hear?
Well, I don't know. It's,
I was wondering if it's making your life more difficult as a cartoonist, because you like to approach people and interview them, talk to them in places like Palestine.
Well, okay, but I haven't been to Palestine since then.
But are you planning to go back?
I'd like to go back. I don't think it's going to affect me personally. I think people distinguish between... I mean, I'm not wearing cartoons on my chest to identify myself as a cartoonist. Yeah, and frankly, Palestinians have a cartoonist that they love and revere. You know,
mm-hmm.
There's a they have a cartoonist that was like kind of an iconic cartoonist. I don't know why his name is escaping me at the moment. I'll catch it in a minute. And he was assassinated in London.
Was that for making fun of Arafat's wife?
No, this is long before Arafat's had a wife. That wasn't Palestine. He was assassinated in the early 80s, and some think it was the PLO, because he was always criticizing the PLO, but he was obviously criticizing Israel, too.
Mm-hmm.
And you often see his cartoons, not often, but I mean enough times I saw his cartoons, or his standard image of a poor Palestinian kid as a pendant or, you know, as a brooch or something like that.
So it's become an icon?
Yeah, it's like an icon. Mm. And he was really highly regarded, and his name's still escaping me. At some point I'll blurt it out, and you'll know what it's all about. Yeah, I mean, I'm not worried about that, frankly.
I think that's interesting, though, that in the public eye, people think, you know, because of this, well, you know, the Islamic movement hates cartoons, but it's all been kind of misfocused.
Well, of course, there's that Iranian exhibition about the Holocaust, cartoons making fun of the Holocaust. So yeah. They don't hate cartoons. But they don't hate cartoons.
Did they actually do the exhibition? Like,
they did the exhibition. Apparently, it wasn't very successful. That's what I've heard. I heard a lot of, you know, people in Tehran, maybe a little wiser than the people putting on the exhibition, just gave it a pass.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine what a success would have been.
It's pretty ridiculous when it comes down to it. I mean, the whole thing just ends up being pretty ridiculous. Unfortunately, it seems to have cost people their lives.
Yeah,
but, you know, my feeling is that a lot of people... It's not... I mean, in some ways, it wasn't really about the cartoons.
No.
It's... Their anger at their own lives, at their governments, at a lot of things was allowed to be directed at foreigners, at foreign embassies. And it's the way... It's almost like society gave them a vent, allowing them to sort of throw themselves on police guns. Yeah, I mean, because it's not... I don't know if it's really about those cartoons. It might be about those cartoons on one level, but I think there's something deeper going on.
I did a paper in school about it. It's an international relations class, and my teacher was like, I don't know if I want you to do this, and I had to, like, really justify saying it. It was basically... I'm not talking about the cartoons, per se, more about how it's just another facet of, like... perceived like Western imperialism of going in and kind of not really respecting cultures as much, and that what it seems more to me than just offensive cartoons. It's just another
thing. Yeah, I think some people thought this is another example of being oppressed, of having a boot on our neck. But I mean, if you look at what was going on, that Danish newspaper is a right wing paper, and to me that there was an obvious provocation. I think it was meant to provoke. I think it certainly got out of hand. It might not be what they wanted to do. But, you know, people who are insecure about their place in the world, and I think in some ways some Muslims might feel that way, in Europe especially, you know, they might be in a position of you know, really worrying about how they're being viewed or whatever, and they want some respect. Now, if you would run those cartoons, if you would run... anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish cartoons in the 1930s, that means one thing. If you run anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish cartoons it means another thing, really. The Jewish community isn't in that same kind of danger now.
Yeah.
I would think. And so they probably can take it in this way. Whereas in the 1930s, it might have been a bit more threatening to them. You know, and I think people think about that. This is a society, on some level, I think that there's some insecurity about their place, and I think they feel like the world is being, you know, is being kneeing them in the groin for a while now.
Are you planning to go back to Gaza, Palestine?
At some point. I don't have, like, immediate plans. I'm working on a book now, and I realize I better finish the book before I do any major traveling.
It just seems that I worry about you when I think about the places you go to, because it seems the situation there has become more serious than when you wrote and drew Palestine.
No, that's true. But I've been back since. I mean, it was a couple of years ago now, or even a bit more than a couple of years ago, but I spent 2.5 or so months there. And I rented a place in a refugee camp.
You can do that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you can do that. I mean, it was...
Money goes a long way.
It was an unusual situation. There are a lot of people who were living abroad. You know, a refugee camp, when you think about a refugee camp, it's not sort of the tent shack thing. It looks like a town. Mm. Concrete buildings, some are several stories high. And so there were a lot of Palestinians who live abroad who were building a home so they could retire and eventually in Gaza at some point. And so, you know, it was someone who was absent, he mm-hmm. was willing to rent out his place to me. But, you know, I take my precautions. I'm fully aware that you cannot go around places like that, sort of la-di-da, I'm impervious to anything. But, you know, I have my contacts. I'm around people who know that I'm there. I'm seen with the right people, that no one's going to mess with me, basically. It's really simple. I mean, on that level, that you just have to... If you're around people who are well-respected in the community, nothing's going to happen to you at all.
Hmm.
Oh, well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, that's a famous line.
I mean, it's gold.
But I never felt fear from Palestinians.
How do you make those contacts?
You know what helps is that I did the book Palestine. It's like a certain amount of doors open in a way, or people understand what you've done. They've seen that you've made a commitment to what their lives on some level. And so they're willing to help you out. And people are willing to go through, you know, great lengths to help you out.
Mm. That kind of bridges. What is it that about Palestine that's just such a topic for you that you have such interest in? It's like that and Bosnia really seem to be your big pieces of work.
Well, they're big because comics take a long time. And so you're known for those two or three things you managed to get out before you die. You know, that's basically it. But I have other interests. But those are the ones that have, you know, I've in a way settled on, because there's only so much you can know about the world, and you realize you maybe should focus, because the more you know, the more you realize you need to know. I got interested in the Palestinian situation because, like a lot of America, I growing up in the United States, I got the Israeli side, the Israeli point of view, from when I was in high school. And without necessarily really paying attention to the news, I wasn't a news junkie at the time in high school, through osmosis, to me, Palestinians were terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time Palestinians appear on TV is when
there was a bus that
blown up or
shop.
Something like that, or, you know, and that was my understanding of it. And just the other side of that is Israel was a beleaguered nation, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, there is truth in that on some level, definitely. But around the time of the invasion of Lebanon in the early 80s, actually it was when Israelis started using bombs that were given to them by the Americans for defensive purposes, and they were leveling apartment buildings in Beirut with them. And I thought, that is... You know, something went off in my head. I thought I was pretty liberal. I was sort of with it about Central America. And suddenly, well, why is this right? And suddenly I began examining the issue in little ways. And I lived in Europe then, and Europeans have a very nuanced perspective of what's going on. And just arguments with people, because I was still sort of taking the Israeli position in a lot of ways, but learning from them, and then just reading the right books. Noam Chomsky's The Fateful Triangle, and Edward Said's books, and eventually I just came to this other conclusion. I felt like I studied journalism, and here my U.S. peers have been pulling the wool over my eyes, and maybe without even knowing they were doing it, but I felt like I was being shafted as a reader. And because I'd studied journalism, I felt even doubly shafted, like, oh, these are the people who are supposed to be objective. And at that point, the word objective was sullied in my in my mind, and I realized there's no such thing as objective, really. This is not objective. And at some point, I got impassioned about it enough to go and see for myself.
Now, the kind of flip side to that is, do you find criticisms from other journalistic outfits of you being, because you're focused on the Palestinian issues and what's happening there, do you face some criticism professionally for taking that kind of pseudo-political stance of, like, here's an issue that we really need to bring into air?
Well, surprisingly, not by other professionals, but I think I am criticized for that, and I think it's a fair criticism, and it's a criticism, I think the way I answer it is to say, I think Americans well know the Israeli side of things, and this is basically a U.S. market that I'm thinking of. Mm-hmm. Americans know about the Israeli point of view, they get it all the time, it's always on the news. When you look at the sense of the Senate, when they make votes, it's always completely pro-Israel. So I'd like to see the other side of the coin, that's all. And my thing isn't to be balanced in the sense that I need the Israeli perspective alongside the Palestinian perspective. My emphasis is on, I want to show what's going on with the Palestinians, and I want to show it honestly. In other words, if there's stuff in there that I think is going to make them sound bad, then that's going to go in there, because you have to be honest. And if, you know, and you're going to get a mixture. It's an examination of a society, not a balancing a conflict. That's how I'm approaching it.
That's something I actually really enjoyed kind of rereading Palestine last week, is that you really get into it, and you kind of you get into the situations with people, but also your thoughts and things, and how, like, wow, this guy is really out there and trying to get that balance in there of, like, this is really over the top, and, you know.
Yeah, sometimes I do that. I would say now if I would have to write some of those scenes, I would let someone be over the top and let the reader just decide for himself or herself if it's over the top.
It's interesting kind of separating yourself from the story, I guess.
So do you strive for objectivity at all, or...?
I strive for honesty, which I think, objectivity is a word that I think what it means is there are two sides to every story. You get one side, then you get the other side. That's what I think most American journalists take objectivity to mean. Mm. If there was true objectivity in that you were, like, looking at some situation as a fly that could just look and observe and incorporate it, maybe that would be great. But the truth is, I'd be a fly from the West. Mm. And there's another filter, you know, it's... I have my prejudices, and that's part of the reason I show myself in my comics. I want the reader to know that you're seeing this through one guy's eyes and one Westerner's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, honesty is more important than objectivity. If you can see the difference.
Yes, I think so.
I think Colin has an interesting little story about something at our local comics.
Oh, store. Yes. I don't know if you know, but... The comic shop on West 4th in Vancouver had a visit from the police once because they were carrying anti-Semitic hate literature, which happened to be issues of Palestine.
Right, I heard about that at the time, and I was actually in that comic book shop yesterday, and the manager, Brent, he told me about it. Yeah, I remember that coming up, but I mean, that was quickly just cast aside as, you know, not...
No, I don't think
serious.
The police took it seriously.
Yeah, they walked in, looked at it, and walked
right.
out.
But you haven't had anything else like that happen, have you?
I know that some proprietors have chosen not to carry the comic.
Really?
In some places in Europe. And that's, you know, that's their right. I have no problem with that.
Hmm.
I have no problem with that. I'd rather it was done as a, you know, the proprietor might be offended by the comic and says, I don't want to carry that comic. I mean, that's fine with me, frankly.
Hmm.
There are enough that carry it, so why worry?
I think it's selling pretty decent.
Yeah,
well, it's all right.
It's hard.
Your story in the latest World War III Illustrated, is this the latest? I think it's the latest. Which was also published by The Guardian originally, Complacency Kills. How is that as a kind of different experience from your regular where you're...
Embedded.
Yeah, you're embedded, you know, hanging out with the army for this one, but rest of your stuff is more with the people and kind of communicating with the people.
You're always embedded. You're embedded with the Palestinians. You're embedded with the Bosnians. You're embedded with civilians when it comes down to it. I mean, it's... I think that word itself gets a bad rap, and it's easy to dismiss the whole process, and there are real problems with the process. But I think a journalist who can get that kind—I mean, journalists scream for that kind of access, and they get it, and then there's all the complaint about what it all means and how they're co-opted. Frankly, I get close to almost everyone I'm around. I got close to Bosnian Serbs who told me things I didn't want to hear, I thought was offensive. But you get close to them as individuals. I got close to the Marines. Doesn't mean I supported the war. And close, I mean, is a very relative term. I mean, you realize it, you know, you're with these people. You're not going to hang back. You want to get into their heads, and you want to see them as people, ultimately.
And I suppose, to a great extent, your personal safety also depends upon them.
It certainly does. I mean, in a way, you know, when you first get there, they do have this sort of heroic feeling, like these are the guys with the guns and I'm in the middle and they are going to protect me. And you know what, in some weird way, they were really very kind to me. Like, I was freezing in the desert sometimes. I mean, literally, I had so many layers of clothes on, but it was like one layer too little.
Mm.
And it was so cold, and they would put me up against the heater in the Humvee, and I mean, they just they take care of you in that way. And I, you know, that's just a part of the experience too. It was an interesting experience because partly I wanted to go and be with an English-speaking group so I could feel like I wouldn't be lost, I wouldn't lose anything in translation. What I found out from the embedded process is because you're a journalist, they are going to be very careful about what they say around you. They are going to present a front. It's just no doubt about it. And I felt, I realized that in some ways, even though I could speak the language, I was locked out of certain things that were happening. It was clear that things were going on sometimes, and I wasn't going to be bothered. They weren't going to bother telling me about them. And so there are problems with it. But I think partly, I sort of think if I'd spent more time with them, a lot more barriers would have come down. I only spent, I mean, the whole process took a month, but I actually spent like maybe 2.5 weeks with that one unit. That was not enough time for the barriers to come down.
Trust levels to be.
Yeah, I mean, I had trust. I had some trust from a few individuals that started talking to me on and off the record in ways that I was sort of surprised by. I mean, it was a reserve unit, so the average age was older, and some of these guys were pretty sharp, and at the very least, a lot of them did not think the tactics were working. The tactics. Mm-hmm. They might have thought it was a good idea to go in, but they sort of saw this, I don't know if we're going to win this war the way if we keep doing it this way. You know, they're smart. They can be smart on, they're smart on that level, certainly. I'm rambling, sorry.
No, that's okay. Right. Okay. You know, that's the neat thing with the show is we can get a chance to get more into conversations with people than, like, kind of when you read, like, you know, printed interviews. It doesn't seem as engaged.
Right. But that was going to be the only way you could actually do a story from Iraq.
Unfortunately, I don't think I have the wherewithal or the language skills or the skin color or whatever to go and pretend I could get the Iraqi civilian side of the story, which mm-hmm. I would really like to get. But I think that it's so dangerous at this point, even for really, like the people who really know that region, that I'm not interested in that. Though I did do a story, another Guardian story, about two Iraqis who were detained by U.S. forces. They happened to be in the United States as part of a lawsuit against Rumsfeld.
That was printed pretty recently.
Yeah, about almost a year ago at this point. But, I mean, so in other words, I'd like to tell that story. And there might be ways of doing it later. But, you know, right now, it's about as close to suicide as it gets as far as journalism
goes. I was just wondering, like, in all the experiences you've gone in some pretty war-torn areas, have you experienced some pretty frightening situations?
I mean, you know, it's all relative. Because you hear other people's stories and your other war journalist stories, you know, and you really realize that yours doesn't really compare in a way. The whole time I was in Iraq, I heard one bomb go off. No, it's not. Well, I mean, there was some mortar fire and things like this and some rockets. But in my immediate vicinity where it was loud enough to really pay great attention, one bomb go off and three shots fired, you know, and that's in 2.5 weeks. The thing is, that's the whole idea, though, complacency kills, because at the very end of that, story, I was on some patrol boats on the Euphrates River, and that, it seemed like a very quiet sector. This is Haditha Dam, and the patrol boats had been sent there so that the personnel could have, they felt it was a rest from their other duty. It was like, oh, this isn't going to be easy. I went on patrol with them, and it was like nothing going up and down the Euphrates. I felt like, okay, it's fun, I've almost wasted my time. The next day, those same boats were hit, and, you know, they lost one guy, and they had several casualties, including a Marine I'd gotten quite close to, very badly injured. So you realize things can go wrong, and you weren't expecting it. Their motto, the battalion motto, was complacency kills. And subsequent to that, after I left, that unit, that battalion, which had suffered very few casualties, lost like 7 men in about 2 months, and the unit that replaced them had the highest casualty rate, has had the highest casualty rate since the war began. They lost 44 men very quickly.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a unit from Pennsylvania. So, I mean, you know, you think it's, that's what's strange. You think nothing is going to happen until something just happens. That's how a lot of these situations are. You don't know you're in a dangerous situation most of the time.
Until it's dangerous.
Yeah.
How does being there with the troops, how does that affect the way you see the broader issues in Iraq?
It doesn't. I mean, I was sort of interested in almost in tactical things. At that point, I thought the story wasn't whether the U.S. should or shouldn't be there. I mean, I'd already answered that question, which was they shouldn't. It was, can they make this project work? And that's what I was more interested in. How is it going to work? And at that point, I wasn't sure which way I was going to go. Being there made me feel like it's not going very well, and now it seems very clear that it's not going very well.
It's a very frightening situation.
It's resolved itself for a long time. That's a mess. That is a mess.
When you were taking journalism in school, was international relations, was that something you were interested in then? Or is it just kind of something that, like, in your worldly travels kind of developed?
I think I was always interested in international relations, in history, you know, history of what was going on, whatever. And to this day, I often don't know what's going on in my hometown of Portland. And then I'll find, oh, what's this going on? What's this development at the waterfront? You know, I don't know what it is. I never even heard of it. And it's you know, much to my discredit, I got to say. But I'm much more, you know, I'm just focused on another town and another place, you know, half a world away. That's just kind of how I am.
We have much the same experience walking down here.
Vancouver looks pretty strange to me. This is the first time I've really been in Vancouver, once when I was 17. And I'm really sort of shocked at the development.
It's Colin, shocking us.
Colin didn't know about this building even existing. This used to be water.
Wow, did it? Is it the villain?
Actually, this used to be the cliff. The end of the town used to be about a block away.
Wow.
And this is built over railway lands.
Wow, this is very quick development.
210 or 2010. We're not looking forward to it.
Oh, they
take a 2-week vacation at that point. I don't know. Go somewhere far away. publishing, most of your stuff is published by Fantagraphics, and then you have a couple of books from Drawing Quarterly. What's the difference between publishing for Fantagraphics and Drawing Quarterly, like the choice to...
This is a very comics-oriented question.
This is Ink Studs.
Yeah. Ink Studs. What's the difference?
Because like the majority of your stuff is published by Fantagraphics, and then you have the two books. I guess they're kind of like a set together now. But originally it was just The Fixer and Soap, I think, was Drawing Quarterly.
Well, frankly, I was with Fantagraphics, and I really like Fantagraphics, but Palestine did so poorly, and I certainly can't blame them. I think they were very brave to publish it. I had no clue that anyone would publish that book, frankly. But I felt like they didn't promote it at all. They didn't push it in any way. And at some point, Chris Oliveris sent me a fax when I was in Berlin. I think he said, I'd like to, you know, publish anything you want to do, really, more or less. Maybe he'd have a different story, but it seemed like an invitation. And so I decided to see what that was like. And subsequent to that, I think, you know, what made me go back to Fantagraphics was that Eric Reynolds joined the staff of Fantagraphics. And for people who don't know, Eric Reynolds is the main promotions guy at Fantagraphics. And he's someone who I felt understood my work, cared about it, and was willing to do what it sort of took just to give it a chance to succeed. And so now I'm at this, I think, a very good point where I do work with, in my eyes, are the best comics publishers in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And they both have their strengths. You know, Drawing a Quarterly is a smaller shop. That Chris Oliveros, the owner, has an incredible vision. I mean, almost everything in his catalog is superb. He just understands what to print. He cares about what he's doing. The production values are really magnificent.
I have to agree.
Yeah.
Well, we've often said so on the show.
Yeah, and, you know, and you're in that, if you can say he has a stable of cartoonists, you like the other horses. You know, you like their work. And Fantagraphics, to me, some of the stuff is a bit more hit and miss, but I think they've been, in some ways, the most important publisher of comics in North America. They've spearheaded a lot of things, like getting into bookstores and just the weight of the material they have that's really has worked,
mm-hmm.
You know, has really made an impact on the popular culture. So between those two publishers, I mean, those are pretty great publishers to be working for.
Oh, I was just wondering, now that you've been doing this work, how would you compare the way your journalistic colleagues in the print and television, how they treat you now as opposed to when you were starting out?
Well, starting out, I didn't even introduce myself to any journalists, basically because I was at that insecure phase where I wasn't even sure of myself or what I was doing, and I was worried about being laughed at, frankly. Now, it's quite different. I've got to say, they treat me as a peer, and that started in Bosnia when I finally started hanging out with journalists. I was like one of the crowd, and what you realize is, if you know your stuff, if you can actually add something to the conversation, if it's clear that you really are aware of what's going on, you're in, you know, and that's it. And they like the fact that I'm a cartoonist. I mean, they kind of get a kick out of that. They like my books, and I've worked with some of them. I mean, in the field, you kind of work with some people. You go do things together.
Exchange ideas and stuff.
And also just for security, or just so you don't feel insecure. I mean, sometimes it's just easier to go to a place if it's two or three people in a car, and you're not as nervous about it because you're kind of BSing the whole way. It helps. So I consider some of these guys and women, you know, friends, and in some ways they're envious of what I do because often they have deadlines and I don't. And if the story takes me to this town, I'll go to that town, and they don't have that luxury.
Well, that's something interesting with the comics medium is to find you can be a lot more honest because you're putting so much time and energy into it. You don't have to, like, kind of trim to make, you know, media happy, because if you're TV and print, a lot of time you have to kind of focus on what it'll be, because you've kind of created your name, you're Joe Sacco, these are the books I do, you can kind of do that book.
I think it depends on each individual journalist. I think there are a lot of journalists who really, I mean, there are obviously a lot of journalists who really know what they're doing, that work really well within that restricted environment. And I think it's essential that they work in that environment, because basically I want to read every day what's going on. I want someone who knows what they're doing to give that to me. Of course, I also want to read a longer magazine piece. And some of the magazine writers also have freedom to sink into a story and go where they want to go. You know, so I don't think it's exclusive to the comics, that only comics can, or a cartoonist can do things this way, but it's just worked out that, you know, it's clear to me that I don't have deadlines except the one I have when I get back by contract, which is usually ignored.
You know? You have some voicemails from eager publishers to...
Well, I need to pick up the pace of the book I'm working on now, but it got longer. It's actually much longer now than when I envisioned it.
And this is the one. It's getting longer. The follow-up to Palestine.
I guess you could say a follow-up. It's about the same subject, you know, Palestine, but it's
kind of touching on different parts of the issues.
It's specifically about the Gaza Strip. It's historical, a bit more historical, and yeah, it's very particular to two towns in southern Gaza.
Looking forward to it.
You'll have to wait.
That happens a lot in this show. People tell us about stuff we want to read. Then we quit a while. You have a question, Paul? You look like... Okay. Influences. What were some early cartooning influences? Because you mentioned yesterday in an interview that your artistic training is a grade 8 drafting class, I think is what you'd said.
Right.
And yeah, you've got such a neat, unique style. And that's all self-taught?
It's self-taught. I think my earliest influence, I'd say, in comics is the EC Mad magazine, Mad Comics. Like, Bill Elder was my earliest influence, because I remember when I first moved to America, there were these Mad magazines where they were reprinting those old EC comics that they were stapled in.
I remember them.
And those blew my mind like Monty Python blew my mind when I first heard it. It just was like that shift in your paradigm. Like, oh, this can be done. You know, I had no clue that grown people could produce such things. And if you look at how busy some of my early work is and all the stuff in the background, that's all, in a way, Bill Elder. It's all, almost the plot is almost incidental to the mania in the background. So he was a big influence. And then Robert Crumb was a really big influence later on when I was maybe in my early 20s. And I don't want to say I aped Robert Crumb, but certainly I wanted to get that sort of organic feel that he got, and I didn't seem to be able to capture, you know, everything.
The Bigfoot sort of?
No, that wasn't it so much. It's the fact that he can draw a coffee mug and it comes with a soul somehow. Everything has character in his drawings, and that's the biggest lesson from Crumb, aside from the fact that, you know, the way he hatches or something like that. And I think I was hatching probably even before I never met him, before I sort of began reading Crumb.
Yeah, your cross-hatching is something amazing, I must say.
Yeah, I actually wanted to stop doing that somehow, but, you know, it's just in my hand at this point. You know, to shift gears and figure out a different way to draw, which is what I almost wanted to do, it's just not going to happen. I'm always going to draw the way I draw, I'm sure of it.
What do you draw with?
Croquel.
Wow.
And the reason I draw with a Croquel is because I just assumed Robert Crumb used a Croquel. Then I found that he used a rapidiograph.
He like, does?
That's what I've read.
Wow.
I was thinking, how does he get that character in his line with a rapidiograph? That seems impossible.
That's insane.
It is. And to me, rapidiographs, I used to use them all the time, and I got no character in the line.
Well, they're a stiff, unyielding line.
Yeah, and it's like it's not... Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. But I started using a Croquel, and now that's the only way I can draw. I can't even use a brush. I don't know how to use it. I'd like to... I mean, I should learn these things, but... You know,
so
learning things just takes time, and I haven't got the time. I've got to do comics.
What size are your originals?
Well, that was a technical question.
We get into odd questions.
All right.
On
the
show.
The sheet of paper I use is 15 3/4. Can I say inches in Canada?
Yeah. Yes.
15 3/4 inches by 12 inches, and in other words, that's where it will bleed if it needs to bleed, and the usual image is 10 inches by, I don't know, 13 and a half or something, 14.
We may get into trouble with the CRTC, but
I think I already swore, so. Yeah. the thankfulness about college radio is we don't have a lot of limits on what we can say.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're doing for time. I think we're pretty much rounding up. It's been about 40 minutes, 45 minutes, I think.
I wouldn't know. It seems like 35 minutes.
Bah! Oh, I'm going blank.
I think I've gone through my list of questions.
You can put music.
Oh, I have actually one more question.
All right. I'll edit out the last 30 seconds.
Okay.
Now, are you still a Maltese citizen?
Yes.
So you were born in Malta, grew up in Australia?
That's right. That's right.
And moved to the United States. But you spent most of your life in the United States.
That's right.
So do you feel yourself as an American, or do you feel yourself just slightly detached from American culture?
Slightly detached when I need to be slightly detached. But I have to say, I feel myself as a North American. You know, there's no getting around it. I feel responsible for the stupidity, you know, sometimes, because you feel like you're in a democracy and all that.
But you don't get to vote.
I don't get to vote, but that doesn't mean you don't feel responsible for it.
What does a vote in the States count for now?
Yes, it's true. It counts locally, and that's why, one of the reasons actually I want to get American citizenship is because I'd like to vote locally, because I think it matters there. You know, national elections, it seems all bets are off now as far as what voting means.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask a music question, actually. There's something I meant to ask. You lived in Berlin before the wall went down and after the wall
went
down.
Yes, that's right.
What was the music scenes there like? Because you were going to gigs and stuff and checking out.
It seemed like sort of ground zero of music scene. But I think maybe every major city feels like ground zero. It wasn't that I was that interested in the German bands, though there were some good German bands. It was that everyone was going to come through Berlin, like everyone comes through New York.
Yeah.
And the thing is, there were only a certain amount of clubs, so you got to know the scene really well. You got to know the people who were working the bar, who were taking tickets or whatever. And it was kind of a great scene in a way. I mean, I probably went to see music 2-3 times a week at least. And I really enjoyed it. They weren't the sorts of records, or the bands were great in a way, watching them and being backstage with them sometimes or whatever. I mean, that was all fun. But it's not that I have a lot of those records, because frankly, a lot of that music just doesn't really stick with me.
What were some of your favorite gigs from Berlin that you went to?
Some of the really good ones, Well, I always thought Mudhoney put on a good show. And also, those guys had a sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to a lot of grunge music, which is all emoting and absolutely humorless. This whole humorless thing started in the 90s, and everyone was like earnest, and the guy next door who's wearing his baseball cap backwards, and he's going to play you his songs about breaking up with his cat or something. You know?
Like awful country for depressed teenagers.
Yeah, just I don't know, just too much.
Oh, they seem to draw a lot from punk, but they forgot that punk also had a sense of humor about it.
And I like humor, and that's what was fun being with the Miracle Workers. Those guys had a sense of humor, and they were into this whole rock star showbiz thing, and you know that's what it's about. And I like that acknowledgement of that, and it meant that girls responded to the band, which is nice to see in an audience, frankly, because when you know, most grunge acts, at a certain point,
it's a
guy thing, and you think, man, is rock and roll just a boy thing? You kind of want to see a mixed group.
Are they still together, the Miracle Workers?
No. In fact, Jerry, the lead singer, just swears off music now.
Oh, I was going through our station the other day.
Bitterness.
Trying to find the Miracle Workers record, because I forgot.
There's one in there.
But I forgot it at home.
Oh,
I totally meant to bring it and play the CD on the show, because we're promoting the signing at Word on the Street, and I found the record, and it was such a, it's like yellow or orange with them all standing proper on the front.
They were real rock stars in the true sense of the word.
It was a pretty classic cover. It was just so, I don't know, was that purposeful? was it ironic, that career, you think?
It wasn't even ironic. It's, they were like, we're rock stars, and we're going to enjoy being rock stars. And we have to pretend we're rock stars so that you can think we're rock stars. It's all image, and it's all attitude. Rock and roll is so much of its attitude, it's, as you know. It's, that's what it's all about. And once it loses that attitude and it becomes a little too close to you, it just loses its glamour, as far as I'm concerned. Mm. I never want to meet my rock icons. I mean, I want Jagger 1,000 miles away. That's where he belongs. He belongs.
A little speck dancing on the screen.
He belongs on top of the speck. He's a video image, even though he's in front of me. That's much. That's how it should be, you know.
Were you a little disillusioned in music after that time of being going to all the gigs and going backstage at shows?
Just got fed up with the whole. I mean. My part in the music business, just the rock posters, people not paying on time, people thinking, oh, you're gonna, this is going to be good exposure doing this poster. It's like, I don't want to hear about good exposure. Just pay me some money.
That.
Yeah, there's always that, you know, the good exposure thing. And just a bunch of flaky people. You're just around too many flaky people in that rock scene.
Not like comics.
Not like comics, yeah. Well, comics, you know, I don't know, but I got a little tired of it. Time to move on.
Comics. Comics are great. Thank you for coming on the show.
I appreciate being on the show. Thank you very much for having me.
His new book, But I Like It, is available in every good comic store.
But I Like It is how you have to pronounce it.
Okay, But I Like It. All right. With a rockin' cover and a rockin' CD in the back. How often do you see comics with CDs? Not often.
Not often enough.
A McSweeney's book had a They Might Be Giants CD.
Hmm.
Wow. Thank you.